Urban Theology. Urban Theology. Hello, you're listening to Urban Theology on Cradio. Urban Theology takes place once a month in the centre of Sydney at the St. James Hotel. It is a little oasis from the hustle and bustle of the increasingly secular city. Young 20-somethings, corporates and university students gather to either listen to an MC lead discussion or a debate on several topics that affect everyday Catholics. This month's topic was all about the wealth of the church. How much money does the church actually have? Where's it all coming from? And how is it being spent? Father Vincent Magat, a young Dominican priest who is the chaplain of Notre Dame University in Sydney, gave a thoughtful and interesting overview of this topic, leaving us with some answers and helping those who were searching. But first, here's your MC for the evening, Kai Chow.
Okay, so everyone, this is the last Urban Theology of the year. Thank you all for coming along, and for those of you who have been regulars, thank you. And of course, anyone who's new, you're always welcome. Now, there's this scene in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. I don't know how many people haven't seen this movie yet. Probably not many of you haven't seen it, but this could be somewhat of a spoiler, so block your ears if you don't want to know roughly how it ends. Don't worry, it's not the very end. Okay, there's this scene where the evil bad guy is in. He has to choose from this vast range of chalices. Which of these is the Holy Grail, the cup that caught Christ's blood at the Last Supper? Please put aside your theological objections to this for the moment. Anyway, so Indiana Jones is there, and he has to also make a choice out of which cup it's going to be, because he has to save his father's life, because according to Hollywood, drinking from the Holy Grail will bring everlasting life. It will it'll basically give you immortality. As the true cup will give you life, the wrong choice will take it away. So the bad guy's looking around, and he asks, the resident floozy to pick it for him. And she picks this beautiful gold cup with the jewels inlaid in it, and she gives it to him. And he says, yes, and it's more beautiful than I ever imagined. And he drinks from it. And for those of you who have seen the movie, you'll know what happens next. He starts coughing, shaking, and then basically violently shaking. And then all of a sudden things start to go very, very bad. He ages incredibly fast. Within seconds, his hair pops out, his eyes pops out. And the next thing you know, he's a skeleton, and Indiana Jones gives him a kick, and it all just falls apart, and he just turns into a pile of dust. And then the knight who has been entrusted with watching the Grail says, you chose poorly. And then there's the scene right after that. So Indiana has to make a decision. He's got to save his father's life. And so he looks around at all of these cups, and most of them are beautiful cups, and he... And then, you know, the alleged floozy, who is now obviously having somewhat of a change of heart because she realizes she's in love with Indiana, says, Jesus was a carpenter's son. And then Indiana Jones sees this little wooden chalice, this little wooden cup amongst all of these beautiful gold ones. And he says, well, there's only one way to find out. And so he dips it in the water and he drinks from it. And the fact that there is an Indiana Jones 4 should tell you that he made the right choice. Okay, so I think for many people watching that movie, it reminded many people of a lot of things. They said, look, we often go to these beautiful Catholic churches in Barcelona and really all over the world, and we see these incredibly ornate places. But really, wasn't the roots of the Christian religion, wasn't Jesus a humble, humble man? From the very humblest of roots, we were always taught to look after the poor. And that's what leads us to our talk today. Because all Catholics, at some point in their lives, even putting aside all of the more modern issues we get confronted about, are always asked, why is your church so rich? all of these incredible palatial type of churches that you have, the gold chalices, the huge tracts of land, the massive amounts of money. Look at those schools. Those aren't humble schools. Those are amazing schools. And so that's often put to us, and that's what we're here today to discuss with Father Vincent. Now, Father Vincent, as many of you would know, is a very young Dominican, which isn't to say, Father Dom, that, you know, they're not all young Dominicans. He's here, and he's, of course, a scholar of the church. He works at Notre Dame University as their... Father, I always get the title wrong. Why don't you fill that one in for me?
As a chaplain.
Yeah, okay. That works. And he's looked into this issue in quite a lot of depth. And so I hope all of you here tonight find it useful and enriching. And if for some reason you don't, well, that's what those pads and pens are for. They're for you to ask the questions that you've perhaps always been asked, or that maybe you've even had yourself. So without further ado, let's start. Okay, Father, first of all, can you give us an idea exactly how rich is this Church of Ours? I mean, you know, we see all kinds of articles. They're saying that the church has gold reserves in the billions of dollars, investments in the United States with fund managers of about $500 million, I've seen. Exactly, is our church the wealthiest institution in the world?
I think in the end this question is very difficult to answer, and the best that one can do is to try to reach the figures that we do actually have. The Vatican has been very open, especially in the last 50 years when accountability to the public became a very important question, about how much money there is in the Vatican and what the annual budget is. And in one sense, let's try to put it into a bit of context with the figures for a few things. For instance, our state of New South Wales has an annual budget of about, I'm told, $55 billion. That's how much this state both receives and hopefully spends. If you compare it to something a bit closer to home, the University of Sydney spends annually around $1 billion, something close to that. The budget for the Vatican, for the organization that takes care of, so to speak, all the Catholics around the world, is, according to the latest figures from about 2008, close to $350 million. So even in comparison to the state of New South Wales, it is a mere fraction of how much the Vatican spends on its services year by year. Of course, it's very hard to try to disprove or prove figures when it comes to, well, the Vatican must have reserves somewhere. There must be gold stored in some kind of vault somewhere that nobody knows about. It's very hard to prove the negative, so to speak. What we can do is, again, refer to what can be disclosed, that the Bank of Vatican, that everybody always talks about, and so many of these conspiracy theories involve, again, is not nowhere near to being the richest institution in the world. The assets that it has, according to its own figures, are somewhere around, let's say, about $5 billion. In comparison to states, corporations, to so many things that there are in our modern world, the Vatican owns a fraction of the total wealth in the world. And one thing that is very important for us to notice, and one which has come out in our Australian situation as well, you might have noticed a few months ago there was a few articles in the papers written about the difficulties that the Anglican Archdiocese of Sydney has gotten itself lately. And that is that they do have a lot of assets, so to speak, a lot of buildings in very well-to-do areas that are technically, on the paper, worth a lot of money, but from which they receive no income. And often enough, it's not only that they receive no income, but that they are a drain on their income. So we can always talk about the church in the same terms, about our Catholic Church, that yes, we do have, the church does have a lot of assets, but these assets do not produce income. And moreover, they are not there to be sold. A few years ago in Melbourne, there was a whole series of articles that the Melbourne Herald planned to do, a sort of expose on the wealth of the church. And the first day it was the front page, and there was the double spread and everything else talking about the riches of the church. And soon enough they realized they ran out of material, because all the riches they were pointing to were lands and property that were used for schools, for hospitals, for things that drained money rather than provided money for the church. And there were not things that the church could boast about, so to speak. There were things that the state itself wanted to continue. The state didn't want to take over all these schools and hospitals and all of a sudden provide from them from the public purse. So the wealth of the church Yes, of course. We do own a lot of land. We do own a lot of assets. But these are not things which we use for our own purposes, so to speak. They are used for charitable and good things.
Okay, but there are many things, though, that the church could sell. Many people are going to point to your paintings, the huge amounts of artworks that the church has had painted for it over the centuries. And it's all very well to say, oh, well, they're priceless, right? But the thing is that couldn't you sell those items and use that money to give to the poor? Because that is what we're told is meant to be at the very heart of our faith.
Let me try to rephrase it a little bit. Put it this way. I've just returned from a retreat with my good Dominican brothers. And we were...
Was Father Dom there as well?
No, unfortunately. But we had a little joke running along it because, put it this way, is the purpose of the church, is one of the leading ideals of our church to give money to the poor, to provide for the poor? Yeah, well, of course it is. So if you have a little bit of money or a lot of money, it doesn't matter how much you have, you should give some to the poor. And it seems the logic of it goes this way. The more you provide a little bit, and the more you provide, the better, surely. If you have $100, you give 10 bucks, that's good. 20 bucks, even better. 30 bucks, better still. And on the retreat, we put it this way. Look, on the retreat, our purpose is to praise God and spend time in prayer. So let's say in the evening we'll do 1 hour's adoration, we'll have benediction at the end, night prayer, and then we'll go to sleep. And then someone would say, well, hang on, if 1 hour is good, then surely 2 hours would be better. And so would three, and so would four, and so would staying up for 5 days and doing nothing else but being in adoration. And the worst part about this kind of logic, this kind of slippery slope, is that, of course, as soon as someone mentions, well, actually, I don't want to do 5 hours of adoration. I think two is enough, or maybe even one. The response that you can bring out, and it's a bit of a joke, the response you can do is you look at them very intently and open your eyes and go, but don't you love Jesus? Why would you only spend 1 hour in adoration when you can spend 5 days straight? And in one sense, the question about the church's contribution to the poor can be asked in the same way. That whatever we do for the poor, the question can always be asked, but why aren't you doing more? Shouldn't you be loving Jesus more? So some kind of balance has to be brought into it.
Okay. Now, something you've said is that, look, you don't want to create a welfare dependency type of mentality either. In other words, if the church just handed over every one of its assets that could be sold and helped people for a short period and wouldn't go much further, that's something you've said. Is that right?
It's certainly something that has come out in the experience of the church. Put it this way, as a Dominican, I'm always very interested in the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas. And Aquinas has this very fascinating idea to do with the questions of virtue, with doing things right. That to every way of doing something well, there are always two opposite vices, two ways of doing things wrong. You can either do too little, or in one sense, you can do too much. And I think welfare dependency is one particular example of doing things too much. You can give too much, you can give the wrong things, you can do things in bad way. And there have been so many examples, so many unfortunate examples, of well-intentioned, well-meaning people who simply misunderstood the situation. There are some parts of the world in which the Catholic Church is one of the few charities, so to speak, that doesn't provide any assistance. Why? Because of what has happened in the past. Let's take an example illustrated in what happens. Let's say you're a poor farmer who works on his land. You work your life away on it, trying to provide for your family. The work that you do produces a bit of food, which provides for your family, and some of it which you sell on the market. And for the money that you sell on the market, you are able to provide for all sorts of things that you are not self-sufficient for. But let's say then that a Western charity with a lot of money behind it moves in. They flood, so to speak, the country with free food. And all of a sudden, all the labor that you do is completely worthless. You can't sell your food anymore, and you can't provide for the things that you cannot grow yourself. And so instead of helping the country, instead of helping these people develop, what has so often happened is that charities have actually contributed to destroying the local economy. Because you, as a farmer, it simply doesn't make sense anymore that you should work on your land. You simply join the queue. You become yet another person who depends on welfare, on assistance from outside.
I mean, Father, surely a lot of people would say, well, that's just an excuse not to provide welfare or foreign aid to anyone then. They would say, well, surely the less aid you provide, then surely that's going to provide them extra incentive to uplift themselves. I mean, I know we're starting to probably verge into political type of territory or ideological type of territory, but what you're saying probably falls in line with a lot of views that many people would say is quite financially or economically right-wing, for example. Okay.
In one sense, perhaps, though I'm not interested in politics in the slightest. What I am interested in is helping people to develop and to do things right for themselves. See, one of the issues, one of the basic questions that underlines our attitudes towards charity and towards help is that poverty is an issue that can be solved by throwing a lot of money at it. It's a very Western idea, and it's an idea that is backed up by the wealth that we have in here. I think the right attitude is not so much the question about left or right politics, about whether people should be self-sufficient or this or that. The question more has to do with what is the cause of poverty and misfortune in the world. And I think to that, the church provides a very different answer to anything that the world provides, to anything that either the left or right of politics provide. From the church's point of view, the answer, the cause of poverty rather, is not about distribution of wealth. It's not about the distribution of food. We are forever told that there is enough food in our world to provide for everyone. The fault is, so to speak, with the distribution itself. And it's not simply a logistical question about flying or driving enough food to particular places. It's about what stops or what drives the human spirit. And so the church quite unashamedly would end up by saying that the cause of poverty has to do with sin, with human weakness, with the things that corrupt us spiritually and not just materially. And so simply throwing money at a problem that is basically spiritual is never going to solve it.
Okay, well, look, let's say then that it's not just about improving financials, our financial lot then. I mean, you mentioned that the church is doing things to improve that. So, I mean, okay, let's say we're not throwing money at the problem. So what's the church doing instead?
By spending a bit of money, of course, no doubt about that. But at the same time, trying to provide an example of what it is that can, in one sense, overcome poverty, overcome the very causes of it. Now, there is always one limitation which I think is very sobering for us who hold the scriptures very dear, and that is Jesus telling us very clearly that you will have the poor with you always. So no matter how excited we can get about social justice, no matter how excited we get about saving people's lives, there is always this limitation. And again, it's not a limitation that we can overcome. If anyone has studied medicine, they would very much understand this problem. No matter how often you save somebody's life, they're going to die sooner or later. And the same, I think, applies to some extent to the question of poverty. You can help lift so many out of poverty, but there is something else that is still needed. And so the church, by all means, I think is one of the greatest providers of charitable help, both in food, in medicine, and in all kinds of assistance around the world. But at the same time, she does provide an example of something completely different. And that is that we do it for the sake of God. We do it in a way that is completely different to how other people approach it. Let me give you an example. And the most basic example is the fact that we have people who give their whole lives. And nothing short of that. That we have whole religious orders in which people devote themselves completely to the help of the poor. Not simply occasionally, not simply from time to time, not in their gap year, not just for a little bit, but everything that there is about themselves. And to that, there can be no better example. That poverty has to be solved by the self-offering, by changing, in the end, the style of life that we live.
Many people would look at, say, the Vatican, for example, and something like World Youth Day, things that involve a huge amount of spending. And then they would look at those people you're talking about who give their lives to the church, the Catholic missionaries, many of whom end up dying for their faith in outreaches all around the world. And they would say, I don't think the church, even within itself, is distributing the money right. The resources, they need to be going to these guys on the front line and women on the front line who are there in the leper colonies, who are there in the toughest areas, not in these showboat type of events such as World Youth Day or these enormous papal masses which must cost an absolute fortune to put on.
put it this way, when the boat pulled into Barangaroo with the Pope and everybody started cheering, I was cheering that Father Dom was on the boat. So, yeah, you know, the Pope came, but so was Father Dom, and that was cool. It's interesting that you mentioned the leper colonies. If you've seen the movie Molokai about Blessed Damien of Molokai, you know that he, at least in the movie, shamefully enough, I haven't read his actual life. I must rely on Hollywood, which is never a good idea. He struggled also with his superiors, that money was coming in, and yet his superiors were not passing it necessarily on to him. But it is important, very important, I think, for us, and maybe we should have brought this out earlier, that there have been times, and presumably there are still occasions these days, where churchmen do very much misuse poverty and wealth, where they amass it rather than spend it for the good of the church and so on. But at the same time, there is something very particular about missionary work that must be kept in mind. And if you excuse me, I'll draw on the example of St. Dominic, that during his time, when he was encountering particular heretics that were taking root in southern France, where he was passing through, the papal missionaries that came there to preach were all Benedictine abbots, all in their splendor, all with their trains and everything else. And St. Dominic realized that the way to convert these people was not by showing the wealth of the church, but by showing its poverty, its simplicity. And so the way he took to his mission was by leaving everything behind, becoming that poor preacher out of which developed everything else. And so for the sake of mission, certainly that is something that is required. But for the sake of the life in the church, in the world as we find it these days, a different approach is again required. So I think the church, very much in her vision, in her wisdom, uses the idea of enculturation, that when we preach to the poor, we are the poor men that they require. St. Paul saying, I become all things for all men. But when we preach to those who are wealthy, to those who are well off, we do take on at least some semblance of that society.
Ooh, see, Father, some would say that's a dangerous example, that then you're glorifying wealth. For example, if you look at what we have within a church itself, for example, why does a chalice have to be gold? Why does a monstrance have to be gold? Why do they have to be made out of these precious and glitzy things that are supposedly against everything that, say, St. Francis or Jesus or really anyone or what Mother Teresa were ever about? And those are usually held out as the greatest examples of Christianity.
Let's go back to something you just said right now. Tell me, was St. Francis a humble man?
I would say he was.
Was he a very humble man?
I would say he was very humble.
Was he the most humble man? Would he deserve a trophy for humility?
Father, is this some kind of reference to that massive basilica in Assisi by any chance?
My point is, let's try to look at it from a different point of view. Was St. Francis a great man? Yes, I think he was. Was he a glorious man? Yes, I think he was. And one way in which the church shows the glory of her saints is by building basilicas, is by showing it by the most precious things that we can find. Now, it is one of the contradictions, so to speak. It is one of the difficult ideas we find.
Yeah, because Jesus, he didn't build any churches. He didn't use gold chalices, did he?
Not as far as I know, no. I think the best way to look at that, at both the example of St. Francis and the example of Christ himself, is probably in this way. If the only thing that was left from St. Francis was this basilica, then yes, something would have terribly gone wrong. But there is a Franciscan hiding over there, and there are very many other Franciscans around the world who hopefully don't live in palatial houses or anything like that. They do follow the true spirit of St. Francis. And I think that is very important, that the witness of St. Francis remains in the church and continues to inspire us. I think it would be very difficult to communicate what this witness would be by a basilica, but by also by having nothing for him whatsoever. Something has to be there. There has to be the order on the one hand, but also something that does show to us the glory of the saints. Now, when it comes to the chalices and to the example that you used from Indiana Jones, I think maybe one way to answer it would be this. When a child is very young, it draws something that doesn't very much resemble you, but it's meant to be you, and the fact that they have tried and have done something good is something that you treasure. But when this child grows into maturity, you do expect something more, put it that way. And the same, I think, can be applied to some extent to the church. when the church was young and humble and not capable of much, so to speak, then the way in which she expressed her glory and love for God was in humble ways, no doubt about it. But when the church does grow in virtue, in strength and everything else, something else does become possible. And the difficulty is that we are forever caught up in this talk simply about charity, that we are always only talking about what we give to the poor, that there is never any other virtue that enters into the picture. Because one thing that comes out from the Dominican tradition is the example of 15th century Florence. Now, I'm not sure how familiar anyone with it is, but if you have studied history, you would have heard about the Medicis, about St. Antoninus of Florence and all sorts of other people. And what they bring out is the idea of magnificence. The virtue, literally the virtue of magnificence, the virtue of spending money well, of doing well with the gifts that God has given you.
I mean, wouldn't people say, well, if you're going to pursue that argument, then you can justify all of the incredible shows of wealth we have in our society. For example, shows like I'm just trying to think of half of that stuff on MTV, which of course I don't watch, but stuff like Pimp My Ride, what's it, Cribs? You know, the ones where they go around and look at incredibly wealthy super celebrities' homes. I mean, these are things that people look at and just think, wow, that is awesome. That is what you do when you are successful. Isn't it a similar, aren't we teaching people that, you know, kind of glorious, huge buildings and beautiful golden objects of any kind, are important? When really, when you look at the life of Christ, when did he ever do any of that?
One thing that people tend to forget about the life of Christ, of course, is his glorious entrance into Jerusalem. Yes, he was riding on a donkey, but people were still lining the streets and singing, "Hosanna, this is the King come from heaven." There is something about Christ that is glorious and that does very much reveal itself even in his life. One can think of the Transfiguration, of course. Glory and the way in which we can express glory by making things beautiful and glorious, so to speak, is not something beyond us or outside us. And the church does express something very human by building beautiful churches, beautiful cathedrals. After all, you know that people, in the absence of worshipping at a church, will worship at a stadium. Not in a field necessarily or something like that, but in a stadium that costs millions and millions of dollars. The church does express in this way something very human about us, that our community spirit is not simply expressed through coming together anywhere and everywhere, but again, this virtue of magnanimity helps us to bring out what is good about us by building beautiful buildings, by building things which express how the human spirit, for that matter, can be raised higher. And in our case, we do talk about being raised as high as God himself. Now, the poor life of Christ is, of course, one wonderful example, but one mustn't forget the temple of the Old Testament. There are marvelous descriptions just before the temple is about to be built about the extreme, one could say, quantities of gold, silver, and everything else that were gathered together to build this most glorious building. And that's exactly what it was meant to be. Now, we do not simply have one temple. We have, so for that matter, tabernacles in every single church. And so to every single church, there passes at least some of this glory of what God himself in the scriptures had prescribed for his worship.
Okay, now you mentioned the life of Christ and you mentioned the temple, which is an object. But many people are going to look at the way a lot of Christ's representatives on earth live today. They'll say the Pope lives in a palace. Not so much here in Australia, where I've seen the very humble car that His Eminence Cardinal Pell drives, but say in some parts of Poland, for example, the bishops, no one ever sees these bishops, they're just driving around in limousines with tinted windows all day. They would say that a lot of the church hierarchy live in an incredibly opulent type of environment. I mean, is the Pope living in a 5-star hotel?
I think the best way to look at it is that the Pope lives in a museum. Very much as the Queen does, for that matter, live in a museum. Technically, they, like the Queen, the Pope owns, I'm not sure that's the right word even, everything that he has around him. But let me describe it to you this way. See, when I was a humble altar server, I did dream about one day being there as the priest, in charge of the liturgy and everything else. And the more I serve Mass, the more I say Mass now as a priest, especially at St. Benedict's, a wonderful church, the more I realize that I'm not in charge of what's happening. when you are surrounded by all of these acolytes, all of whom are trying to take over everything, you are the one who gets commanded what to do rather than doing the commanding yourself. And I think something very similar happens to the Pope as well, for that matter, and the bishops. Now, it's very true that in some parts of the world, again, the poor bishops are misusing and misunderstanding their position. But at the same time, we do have to remember, and St. Thomas Aquinas, again in his writings, brings this out in a certain sense, that there are ranks in the church, just as there are ranks in the world. And so to those who have the fullness of the priesthood, there also belongs a certain position in the world. They have to deal with the world on a certain level. And before you say that, you know, this of course brings the message down, the message of the gospel makes them less like the example of Christ that they're meant to be. There's a very interesting passage in Scripture, one that is forever, I think, misunderstood or very hard to understand. When Jesus talks about the parable of the dishonest servant, the dishonest manager, was about to be dismissed because he's been useless at what he was doing. And then comes his final reckoning when he calls in all the debtors of his master and tells them all to write on their check less than they actually owe. And it's very hard to understand and very hard to make sense of what the preacher should say. Is Jesus literally glorifying this honest way of dealing with money? I think the best way to understand it is this, that the reason that the man was being dismissed in the first place was because he was completely useless at his job. Not that he was enriching himself, but that he was simply wasting money. And if you want to an example of people wasting money, look no further than the Dominicans. When we were renovating our priory in Adelaide, I'm told, yes, quite some time ago, that the choice was between going for gas lighting or electricity. And the brethren decided that electricity was not here to stay and went for gas instead. So the reason the manager is being dismissed in the scripture story is because he's completely useless. He's wasting all the money. The reason why he is praised after he was dishonest is what comes out in Christ's words in the end, that he says, dealing with money, this tainted thing, has to be done well. That one has to use money for something. One has to use it well. One has to use it to win friends in the world. Because forever, no matter what you are doing, you have to have some contact with the world. You have to speak to the world in some way that they will understand. And if it means that you are the bishop, you are the dignitary of your diocese, and the only way to speak to the world, to the dignitaries of the world, is to be at least in some sense on their level, to share in some of the trappings, then so be it. All of these trappings, of course, are external to what happens within your own spirit. God forbid that it should infect your own heart. But even in the life of the bishop, even in the life of the pope, it is something of an expression of the difficulty, of the tension in which our church forever lives, that we are not of the world, and yet we are always found in the world, that we have to use the currency of the world, but not become tainted by it.
Let me ask you, Father, what do you think of, say, the CEO of one of the big banks in Australia or a major investment bank? He's got properties everywhere. He's in the, you know, he's in the corner office on the top floor of the most spectacular office building in the city. And he would say, well, you know what? I'm the CEO. You know, in order to command this vast bank, I need to give people, I need to relate to them and to show my trappings and show that all humans respect wealth. They respect, someone who's at a certain level. I mean, couldn't that logic also be applied to what you've just said?
First of all, though, it's important, I think, to clear out one misunderstanding that would be possible there, and that is that administration and ranks in the world, just like ranks in the church, are not an evil thing. You do actually require someone to, as you say, command the hundreds and the thousands and the tens, for that matter. And these people do carry a responsibility which is greater than those who work below them. And so I think it is fair enough that some people are paid more than others in the world, and that some people thereby, you could say, acquire greater wealth than others. Again and again, the question comes back to the same question of how well do we spend this money and what do we spend it for? With little or with much, with both, it is possible to live what I would call a good and genuinely godly life. If the causes of poverty are about sin, then surely the causes of wastefulness and of luxury, of a luxury that insulates rather than opens up to the world, is sin again. I think a godly life can deal both with wealth and with poverty, with simplicity and with nobility.
That's the end of Act One. Would you all please join me in giving Father Vincent a hand?
Part one of December's Urban Theology. Coming up, part two. You're listening to Cradio.
Urban Theology.
Mm-hmm.